better where they've got a chance of constant water conditions. In particular, it's true of the honey plants, that the honey plants of swamps and margins are the most reliable honey producers of all plants. So swamps and margin vegetation is really the best place to produce your honey plants because the water conditions are so even for the plants. They don't have like blue gums in Tasmania or yellow box or something may flower every 7 years when the moisture conditions are right, whereas marginal plants are regular annual and long-term flowering plants. So you've got the loosestrife, the lithrum and all those, and the marsh marigold, Kaltha, and a tree which is a classical tree is the marsh tupelo, and that's also a classical honey, tupelo honey of the margins, and a loosestrife, which is a pink perennial herb, marsh marigolds, the Kaltha, which are carpeting perennials, and the marsh tupelos, all famous, and the tea trees, all quite famous for their honey production. In fact, there are a lot of swamp plants that are high honey producers, but these are three or four. So the marginal plants then become useful to attract insects and to feed bees and to on you go. And there's quite a lot of fish which depend on the fall from the marginal vegetation for their existence. And almost all the vegetarian fish in a lot of ponds depend on a lot of fall from the margins. You can grow plants which lollop out into the water like comfrey right here. That's a if whatever else doesn't eat comfrey, ducks love it. You've got to put a lot of comfrey in before you put the ducks in. You've got to out-comfrey them before they get there, otherwise they'll eat the lot, particularly the light breeds of egg-laying ducks, the runners. Lots of plants to put on the margins. So your marginal vegetation selection is also quite very important in relation to what you're going to produce in the pond. Right. Now, none of this is very well dealt with in books on aquaculture, and you have to go to little specialist books on the growing of taro or something like that, and none of it's very well integrated. So you don't get an integrated idea of how to set up a pond.
Will it be integrated in your next book?
Oh, yes. Yes, only integrated ponds. My next book, yeah. Actually, I integrated ponds in permaculture too a bit, I thought. We'll go into that too in a minute. Right. Okay, now as far as animals are concerned, there's a very broad range of animals grown in ponds from in the invertebrates. There's a very large harvest of insecta. Other things look like back water boatmen. In Mexico, the water boatmen are harvested by the tons and largely exported, as a high protein food. They're eaten, made into sort of little patties or tacos with flour, and they have egg masses, so they've got high nutrient value. They're also then dried and exported very largely to Britain, where they're incorporated into other foods. Britain imports a lot of dried water boatmen. Just some weird things in world trade, you know, things you stumble across, like all these Mexicans hauling all these damn insect nets from England. And they've been doing it for ages too. I mean, they've been doing it for a century or two. So, it's not as though it's a new trade. That would suit West Australia, growing water boatmen for export to England. The yield is fantastic because of the breeding rate of the water boatmen, and as long as summer lasts, you can haul them by the ton. And in the other invertebrates, there's a whole crustacea class, which are probably very important, and the mollusks. Now, these are two large classes of animals, invertebrates reared in the water. Crustacea break down to sort of shrimp, prawns, which have a rostrum, as against shrimps, and crayfish, which have large thick carapaces, and lobsters, which have great big claws, and yabbies, and marrons, and gilgies, and all those guys, all those hundreds of other guys with local names. Now, all of these are cultivated. For instance, in the prawns, there's been a huge surge in the macrobrachium, or big lungs, I guess. Prawns, and there's a huge culture production of them. Extremely high return. Expect about $30,000 to $40,000 per quarter acre of prawns per annum because of the huge price of prawns, which are about $9, $12 a kilo, something like that. And these are high quality prawns, they're very large ones too. Freshwater prawns, grown now a lot in Hawaii. There's thousands of acres of these grown in Hawaii. A lot of people just grow a quarter of an acre, half an acre of them. Well, they used to feed them on chicken pellets, which were flown in by Boeing 727. Typical American production, eh? I suppose. Should I say that? Into Hawaii, yeah, they used to fly all these chicken pellets in and feed them. And they found one guy, a Japanese guy, actually he's a mate of mine, he was feeding his ducks on these chicken pellets and floating them, and he found they really, what they really liked was duck shit. So, yeah. So it wasn't the pellet, it was the manure, it was the nutrient base in the pellet that they wanted. So he just feeds them on chicken manure. And what all you're up to is growing, what they eat is neither chicken shit nor chicken pellets. What they eat is single-celled green algae, which are the converters of the nutrients. So chicken manure is ideal thing, just a few handfuls per quarter acre per day. Pardon? And you've got to have your algae. So a Secchi disc is 7 inches across. I don't know why 7 inches. Mr. Secchi made the first one 7 inches. And when you put this white disc in the water and put it down, it's got to disappear in about 2 feet. It's got to be completely greened out. And that's a high quality. So it's a real green pond that prawns grow in. Right. So if you can see a Secchi disc 3 feet down, you haven't got enough algae yet. So you just add more chicken shit, so it's a really easy system to run. Yeah, that'll clean them out.
That
DDT.
That was on his third year.
The older one will clean them out.
Yeah. Mm. But he'd be very interested to know this about not feeding them chicken pellets. It costs him quite a lot of money.
Yeah, well, actually what he's doing, he isn't feeding them chicken pellets at all. He's feeding them on the diatoms and algae that are decomposing the chicken pellets. And your chicken manure is one step further on the decomposition line, and then your algae are just fixing the nutrients. So he should at least try a pond of marrow fed on chicken shit. Because the easy way to feed him is to float a flock of ducks on them. Feed your ducks and let the ducks do all the distribution. And if it's not green enough, just add a duck.
What sort of water turnover is that then?
None. These are all still ponds. For the main part, the most I'll have them in is a trickle of water, about a half-inch pipe going into a quarter-acre pond. But most of them are true still ponds. They don't have any flow through at all. Yeah, it's no good making them over 2 metres because there's no light penetration, so there's no turnover much. And mainly they're about where you can work a net. They're mainly about bosom high, I suppose, about the level of my glasses, so you can pull your nets and keep and still breathe. Yes, there's a whole range of these macrobrachiums, if you want to look at them. 28 species in culture. Yeah, they go through a... Well, they don't go to the extreme cold. Then you've got to move to your crayfish. If you want to grow in icy conditions, you've got to bring in European and Tasmanian and Canadian crays. But the macrobrachium goes from, say... cool temperate to tropical. Rosenbergi is the one doing best. It's not actually doing the best. It seems to be the one they're breeding the most of in Hawaii. But there's bulk macrobrachiums, just bulk, you know. And all of them are grown, some in Africa, some in South America, some in Southeast Asia. Macrobrachium?
Yeah,
macrobrachium? Yeah, some of the Argentine ones.
Right. Can you get them here in Australia?
I don't know that we can. We also have a lot of macrobrachium, which we're not culturing. Yeah, some monster prawns in the billabongs on the Murray, and we're not culturing. So they're in the wild condition, you know, subject to a lot of predation. And why we're not culturing our prawns yet, I don't know. I think we're starting to. That guy is culturing macrobrachium rosenbergi on his cane farm. He just put walls around his cane fields and put his prawn. He's culturing banana prawns, which he's catching as immatures in the river. Yeah. But generally speaking, we're not... Well, I don't know, as I speak, things could be changing in Australia, but I don't know of any large prawn culture areas where you can buy your prawn stocks.
Up in Darwin, there's started one, haven't
they? A prawn breeding centre. Nothing would surprise me. I mean, that's the area for prawn culture, all right, all that north area. As soon as you get over 40 inches of rainfall and clay bases and got chicken shit, you're in business.
Excuse me, Bill, you talk about still ponds.
Yeah.
Narrowing and things like that generally involve
flow.
So, what you rely on wind speed or something like the surface?
No, you wouldn't grow a marron in an anaerobic pond. There's a whole lot of things you grow instead of marron. The second great set of... a lot of people now are growing yabbies, and 8 hectares of yabbies is a full living for you. That's not much land, 16 acres in yabby ponds. And about $40,000 to $50,000 a year net profit. Because you don't... do much about the abbey, you simply harvest the damn things. And as yet we're not intensively growing the abbeys on chicken and pellets or anything, although we're growing marron intensively. So you're operating between 1/4 acre and 8 acres depending on your management of your pond, and we're growing marron all over the place, and I think the large marron growing centres are in northern New South Wales. They seem to be going for it big up there. And they have about 16 hectare farms of marron. All along the back of Gold Coast, they're growing marron now, and that's spreading very fast. They're getting the best growth rates in Australia there. They also grow marron in Victoria. And they're getting about $16 a kilo at present, as against six for yabbies, you see. So, the Marin breeding was developed here by Neil Morrissey and others, I think, and it's being taken up very enthusiastically in the east. So there's all these guys, right? And then there's the mollusks, and there's one great list of those being grown. For instance, there's all the freshwater mussels, which are very large. You've seen them, I'm sure. Ours are about this size. They belong in the family Unionidae. After Unio, which means a pearl, and it's where onions got its name. Onions took their name from pearls, right? So we still got pearl onions too, yeah. So all the pearls that were ever grown, right up to very modern times, were grown in freshwater mussels. Now there's a large culture of mussels, simply for pearl production. And again, this is weirdo, all those pearls are used medicinally. They're dissolved in vinegar and used medicinally, except the very finest of them. So the largest culture of mussels is for medicinal use of the pearls, although they have a secondary very high meat yield. The meat yield from these mussels is about 35% of the gross weight. Quite highly priced. And it's about 1,000 kilograms per hectare. Now, the interesting thing about the mussel is neither that it grows lots of pearls or that it has lots of meat yields. It is that it enables you to highly fertilise ponds without killing the fish. Because if you're going to grow prawns, you should grow mussels in the pond base. So you put your mussels in first, a good bucket full of them, and then grow your prawns, and then you can put your chicken manure in quite heavily. And instead of the pond going anaerobic, the mussels pump in particular phosphate. They're the largest reserve of phosphate in the whole of the ecosystem. If you want to look for phosphate fixes, don't look in plants. It's your mussels that are... If you look at your phosphate cycle in nature, your big store is in the freshwater mussels. What they do, they've got... exhalant and inhalant siphons and an anal siphon in the mud, they're buried to there. They put through about 200 to 400 gallons of water a day, sieving out the organisms on the gills, and they excrete directly below the mud. So they're fixing a lot of excess nutrient in the mud. So this becomes phosphate and potash rich mud. And you don't have this overgrowth in the water of decaying material that you do have if you don't have mussels there, particularly decaying plant material. And they're continually ploughing the bottom too. So not only they're fixing things, they're slowly releasing it. It's a very good buffering system. In any pond where you're adding nutrient, mussels are basically critical to pond health, to water quality. Apart from that, you can eat them, and apart from that, until very recent years, most of the harvest was to make pearl buttons out of the shells. And they still... where was I recently? West Africa or Seychelles are still growing mussels to make their pearl buttons. So there's another use for them. And they make artificial pearl paints out of them by dissolving them and all that stuff over. I haven't seen anybody painting anything pearly lately, but in the 20s and 30s, in the Victorian era, everything was painted pearly, you know.
Can you buy stuff as well?
You don't have to. There's not a country in the world from the Arctic to the tropics that doesn't have several large unios, including West Australia. I've got buckets full of them down in Cambrai. Every little creek around here is full of them. Ponds.
Size ones like that?
Yeah, monsters. You guys have got monsters. All over Australia we've got them. We'd have about 50 species, I guess. We got them down Tasmania and we got them everywhere. You never have to get them in.
They breed
good breeders. There's two breeding modes, one free-swimming Norpleus, which settles, is the still water form, and one which briefly attaches to the gills of fish and travels on the gills and then drops off. So that's how the mussels get upstream.
So what about toxins that they carry? You know, they say like shellfish because they go through all this water.
Yeah, if you were, for instance, feeding these on sewage with high toxic levels and then eating them straight away, you get toxins. You've got to clean them for a couple of days. The other thing is that mussels are good at concentration of zinc. Not that good, but you can get 13% of the flesh dry weight. That's an emetic dose. So you eat six mussels and you chuck if you've got zinc pollution. The fact that there are good zinc concentrators and you can measure the zinc in them makes them very important to us in Australia, because generally most of our problems, particularly in West Australia and the Kimberleys, is zinc deficiency. And particularly if you're a whole grain vegetarian, you're likely to be very zinc deficient. So if you're a whole grain vegetarian, you're going to chomp on mussels anyhow. So you're still going to be zinc deficient. But a proportion of mussels in normal diets, and you get a good zinc intake at an assimilable level. That's mainly what's wrong with the Kimberley Aborigines, is zinc deficiency, causing stunted growth and lots of other problems. Zinc deficiency, copper excess, and iron deficiency. There are mussels right through to Alice Springs, great scads of them in the ponds up there. So they're right through the dry areas.
Did you need to put them in where you've got marin?
I would say so, if you're going to manure the water, because the occasional mussel is eaten by a marin. As it sickens and its shell opens, the marin have got it. If you've got millions of mussels, some got to die. They don't live for a million years, eh? So say they live... Well, they live quite a while, mussels, actually. I've kept them in aquaria for years and years and years. They live 8 or 10 years at least, mussels, probably 12 years. But a 12th of them have to be dying annually, so they provide a food source for the marin. And then they got this great thing about keeping your water quality buffered, so that you can make little mistakes in pond nutrition, and they're buffering that for you. And they're part of your whole water cleansing process. I believe a very important part of water cleansing, the removal of excess nutrients from water. And also of a lot of organisms. They're another thing which eats anything swimming around, including bacteria and amoeba. They don't get dysentery. Well, if they do, it doesn't matter, you know. They're a real good throughput. And they're not liable to get dehydrated with dysentery, that's the whole thing. Yeah, that's it. Unlike us. Montezuma's revenge is just food for them. So all this group, then an enormous number of shellfish are grown. Both inland and now, for instance, I don't know the name of this the Chinese snail in Hawaii is this little water snail, little reddish guy about that big. Called Poo Poo. Poo 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 is his name. I can enliven your morning by singing you a little song if you like. A little Hawaiian pond song. I say, the men say, Poo Poo Poo. Poo-hoo-poo-hoo. Now the women say, that's right, they call this little seductive voice. Poo-hoo-poo-hoo, hine-hine-e. That's what the men say. It means, come here, come here. Oh, mo-e, mo-e, poo-hoo-poo-hoo, hine-hine-e. And it's a little trick song. You call to the snails and say, the women say, come here, we won't hurt you. And then the men say, gotcha, you bastards. So everyone sings it, you see. Poo poo oo, hine hine. Poo poo oo, hine hine. Hey, hey, mo, hey, mo, hey. Good in taro fields. You have another song where we all get our arms around each other when we stamp in the floor of the taro flat and do it our little thingy, you see. So a lot of those songs really are based on work. But it's not work when there's a whole line of you treading your taro fields down to seal them. And then there's all little songs about every part of the water culture. Some I remember, some I don't. Right, some I'll get my feet trodden on. Right, now, so there's these guys, these pu'u, which are very good in the taro fields because they eat some of the weeds, and they are the highest value crop out of the fields. That is, they're $25 about for 1.5 kilos of pu'u. About that big. Yeah, snails. So they're the big cash crop out of taro. They bring more money in than the taro. Of course, the duck will eat pu'u. So you've got to separate your duck system from your pu'u system, although duck don't eat the mussels. Can't get the mussels. Some duck eat the mussels, but most duck don't eat mussels. There's only a sort of a brant goose or something that twists them out and gets them. So they are grown, coiled snails, and there are quite a lot of coiled snails grown through China and Oceania and South America. They grow quite a lot of snails in their ponds. And then when you move into the ocean, there's a whole raft of mollusks, mussels, oysters and so on. Can you feed the world on oysters? And the answer is yes. There's a fantastic paper which I've got somewhere saying, can we feed the world on a few acres of oysters? And the guy says, yes, you can. That is, if you take a little bay in West Australia and intensively grow oysters, you can feed all West Australians and practically everybody else in the world in high-protein food because of tremendous efficiency of the oyster in conversion of food. It's a matter of 2 or 3 days after nutrients get in there, it's all in the oysters. But he also points out that when he found this out, he went back to Maine and put in his oyster farm and grew enough oysters to feed America. But he didn't make any money out of it, and he didn't really feed many people because there was no infrastructure. But it's all very well to grow the oysters in that bay, then you've got to have shuckers and chillers and trucks, and he didn't have any of that. So he was stuck. He had a lot of oysters, but he didn't have all this huge infrastructure. Which always accompanies an oyster industry. You've got to have a whole series, a chain of other backup things. So like a lot of things, you can go grow it all right and you can feed the world all right, but the world can't get it because you haven't got anyone to split it or do whatever you've got.
How do they, when they farm, how do they encourage them to breed?
It's one thing you don't have to do with an oyster, it just does that itself.
So what do you do, just hang tires down?
No, oysters for the main part have free swimming little eggs and sperm, and they have a free swimming phase. You can make a special little breeding pond which is only about a metre deep, and you organise the tide in that pond as you regulate it, and you cover the bottom with a sort of catch of 5 millimetres across. You sieve, you crush oyster shell, that's what they like the best, any shell, and you sieve all the fines out, keep all the 5 mil pieces and throw all the coarse pieces away. A 5 mil piece of cut, you'll just take one oyster, little oyster. And so you cover the whole of the bottom of this pond, on trays if you like, with this ideal size of little crushed oyster shells. And then the eggs all settle out, and your oysters breed best if they're submerged 60% of the time of the tide cycle. And they grow best if they're submerged 40% of the tide cycle. And also, you can adjust the temperature. They breed about 20 degrees. That's a Pacific oyster, but each one's specified. So if you want to warm your water, you can induce spawning, and you get billions of little oysters. But mainly all you do is just hang cuts out or just lay trays out in natural beds and let them get on, and then just spread them out on your trays. Each little bit's got an oyster on it, and just spread them on your trays. Mussels, you just fray large ropes and hang them off rafts. A lot of things you do that. And the mussel spawn settles in the rope, and then you sell a rope of mussels to whoever. Chinese do that with their seaweeds too. They breed the algae and put frayed rope in, and you buy the rope for your farm. And you hang the rope up and the algae grow, and you get, you know, the nori. That's how you get that. You just take your old rope in, they put it in the breeding tanks, give you your rope back, and you go grow your nori. And so you do that with mussels and oysters, and then they're growing pearl shells, and I don't know what they're not. They're starting to grow the giant clams now on the Barrier Reef, you know, the big guys. They're breeding those. Quahogs in the United States, all sorts of shellfish we never hear about, all being cultivated and released or grown out in ideal situations in farms, shallow water farms, or in inshore ponds in Tasmania. Now they're pumping seawater, lifting it very slightly, about 5 feet, and just growing oysters in canals. So all sorts of ways to do that. A lot of sorts of shellfish to grow like that. Some in deep mucky mud, like the big, we call these big guys. Razor clams. You've got plenty of those guys, I reckon, haven't you? Razor clams. Yeah, well, they're growing quite a lot in the States too. They need quite soft bottom. So a lot of mollusks being grown, mainly in specialised cultures, but some accessory, like these two we've dealt with, accessory to pond cultures. This one for weeding and this guy for water quality maintenance. Strongly recommended in the tropics for that. And insects are being grown. And then you've got fish. We'll deal with those separately. And the main way we divvy those up is not so much on species as on food habits. Because it depends on, very strongly, on the selection of mixtures of fish in ponds as to what their food habits are. And many of them are very beneficial. Do we knock off for a morning cup of tea, or when do we do that?
When you're ready.
I'm ready. I've been ready for an hour. Waiting for you guys to rise on mass species or, you know, what sort of fish. We'll just talk a little bit about how we would choose fish. We choose them on their food characteristics. There are some fish which just eat mollusks. And if mollusks are a problem, or you've got a good source of mollusks, either of those, then they're good. Some, of course, eat algae only. Some are mainly on diatoms. For instance, most of our grey mullet are diatom eaters.
What's a diatom?
It's just a little unicellular animal with a little siliceous skeleton. It's that little slimy coat that's on practically everything is diatom in the water. They're all stuck on the inside of your tank, and on all the twigs there's diatoms. And some eat only weeds and grasses. And there's quite a whole group of fish in this area. And then as you come up, there are specialised feeders like these guys on other animals. And then there's fish that eat fish, or general carnivores. And there's a whole group of omnivores which will eat plants and plankton. So they've got all those food habits. And then the other thing they have is they break the pond up in spatial things. So there's fish that eat only at the top of the water. There's surface film feeders. They don't come down at all. Fish that only eat at the bottom. Like the catfish group generally, they've all got barbels because it's real muddy and They can't see down there, so they always feel in their way along, got these long whiskers on them. And the mouth underneath, whereas these guys got suctorial mouths. And there's fish that feed through the column, and fish that are really just mid-water fish. Fish that feed through the whole column of water. Fish that are edge browsers, just eat the vegetation here on the edge. So that, as well as their food habits, a fish with the same food habit, like the plankton eating fish, may actually also break up into different species according to where they are in the water. So you can get quite a selection of fish. Now these don't interfere with each other, either in their food habits, except for this guy that eats fish, or where they live in the water. So you can stock quite a lot of fish without them actually being in any direct competition at all. In fact, it's very common to find, by adding a group of the right sort of fish, that the growth of this is totally unaffected by adding another 20 species of fish. That is, there's no reduction in the growth of this species if by adding other fish at all. And that's common and usual. So you can add quite a lot of sorts of fish, provided you've done this selection. And then the other thing we choose fish for are tolerances, oxygen tolerances, free oxygen in the water. There are fish that don't need any oxygen in the water, there's a whole group of them. And therefore they're all air breathers. They have all sorts of lung sacs or almost true lungs, some of them, or special storages in the body for air. So India grows a lot of these. Katla, perch and all those guys, they don't need any oxygen level in the water. They live in clogged up, anoxic sort of situations. And there's a whole raft of these guys. They have high oxygen, low oxygen tolerances, and they break up like this as well. So there's a fish which need highly oxygenated running water and can't live without it. The trout are very typical there. It's probably got to be running water if it isn't naturally very high oxygen. And there's fish tolerant of different salt tolerances from, some of our Australian fish will tolerate up to twice seawater concentration of salt, up to 6,000, 11,000 parts per million salt. Some of the inland waters. Other fish basically won't tolerate 500 parts salt, which is quite drinkable. So there are salt intolerant and tolerant species. So when you're making up your group, you also would select for your water, natural water type as well. One of the problems we have with heavy rainfall, both subtropical and tropical ponds, is you can bring in and grow a grey mullet or milkfish very well in brackish water, then you get a heavy rain and the rain is so heavy that it dilutes the ponds and a lot of fish die. They lose a lot of fish from heavy saltwater fish in heavy rains in those areas. And the opposite can happen, that you can get a high tide or a typhoon or something bringing salt water into what are essentially freshwater ponds and lose fish that way, but they're catastrophic events. So, and then the stages at which you add fish, broadly speaking, it's a very good idea to add fish in equal size groups, no matter what their eventual size can be, because it'd be interesting to do, if you do a trout-eel relationship, both prey on the others. It's just that the size groups prey on the smaller size groups. So if you want to count your fish in and count them out, you've got to put even size groups in. Otherwise, if you let one grow much larger, then the other becomes its food. It's particularly true of trout and eels. Big eels eat trout and big trout eat eels. Equal size guys grow up quite happily together. They just can't stomach each other, more or less. So the size of the mouth in relation to food is really quite a critical thing in fish. As somebody very simply said, Mr. Winkler or something, it's what they can get in their mouth often things will eat. So you stock at even sizes and you can mix the fish up in this and that form and select here. And the better you make this selection, the less you've got to alter the pond conditions from natural pond conditions. pH is another factor. If you're looking at coastal lagoons on old coastal peats, you can expect very low acid pHs released by the peats on coasts. Whereas if you're looking at lagoons in sand, I mean the pHs in Australia vary from 3.5 to 11 in water. That's the range you can expect in the state of Tasmania, for instance. We get that range of pHs. And that cuts out a lot of mollusks up this end. And but other fish can stand it. And that's 10.5 is lethal to most fish, except highly adapted fish for alkaline waters, mainly in the mullet groups and some galax. Typically in a sand dam coastal lagoon, shallow lagoon with a lot of weed in, the pH will go past 10.5 at night. And a lot of cara, weed that's a sort of full of calcium skeleton. At night, it seems to release a lot of calcium into the water. So if you're just doing your day pHs, coastal lagoons sometimes down at 9, we've had them hit 12 at night, and that's extremely alkaline for fish. Trout die at 10.
What's the pH of the sea?
Sea's a little above, about 7.5. Yeah. A little above neutral. Neutrals, you've been through pH, I guess. You don't get many mollusks here at all if you do, they're very minute. And all the crayfish that live down here at pH 4, which is the humus waters of our tea trees, they all eat their shells and they carry all their calcium in stones in the stomach. So when they cast their shells, they eat the shells to get the calcium back, or they store it all in these stones and throw off a calcium depleted shell and then put the calcium back through the bloodstream.
What about crustaceans that are found in caves,
say? Don't know about them, but in those limestone caves they'll be looking at pHs of 8, 5, 9, and they've got tons of lime.
They generally don't have shells, that'll be a different reason.
Yeah, because probably nothing eating them there. Probably nothing down there to eat them. If a crustacean hasn't got a shell, he's pretty unprotected.
Right, yeah.
Highly specialised ones. You could grow them in old abandoned caverns or something.
Yeah.
Don't have to shell this crab. When there's a really sad thing happened in Maine, all these crabs come inshore, all the ladies come inshore and take all their clothes off when they're going to breed, and the males mate with them when they do cast their shells, and all the fishermen get them and eat all these soft-shell crabs, which are all these ladies in their wedding dresses, you're chomping into them, their little legs sticking out of your sandwiches. It's kind of sad, really. I like them, actually. But I sort of just like eating one occasionally. Yeah. So, there you go. Right. So, there's quite... I have actually great pains to myself listed all the fish that are grown, plus some that are not, that could easily be. But we don't hear of a lot of fish. So most places grow their own fish. Like Africa grows a whole range of fish, which we don't. South America, particularly around the Amazon, they just grow dozens of sorts of fish, which we don't culture at all. And then China has its own, a whole array of Chinese carp, which cover all these cases, the carps. And India has the Indian carps, plus a whole group of fish for low aerobic waters. And Europe is fairly poor in cultivated fish, but it has has its own carp, which is a very poor eating fish, as against the grass carp, which is an excellent eating, sometimes called the white Amur carp. Grass carp, the same carp, because they come from the Amur River. These are one of a fish that is both excellent to eat and very low on the trophic chain. It just eats grasses and vegetation. Used a lot in ponds near food processing centres where you've got waste vegetation like pineapple husks or something to eat, all that stuff. They're also used a lot in the United States now for cleaning ditches where you don't want to use sprays. So they stock them with white Amur carp, and they used a tremendous amount to suppress rampant under, like, Elodia and those rampant weeds of the water. And they're very successful at it. They eat most grasses, or most plants, that would otherwise be rampant in water. And they just stick to plants, so they don't interfere much with other fish. And they're excellent fish to eat, so that's one very popular Chinese carp, or it's Russian Chinese, because the Amur River is on the border of Russia and China.